Welcome to The Great Stories. I'm Trev Downey, and each week I'll read and then discuss a truly great short story by one of the iconic authors. Who doesn't enjoy being told a tale? Humans have been telling each other yarns as long as language itself has existed. Stories to entertain, to inspire, to frighten, and to teach. On this podcast, there will be no academic elitism. We will focus only on the story you'll be told, the context in which it appeared, and the author responsible for its creation. The Great Stories, you see, is for everyone. So, gather round, and let's enjoy this episode's tale. The Most Dangerous Game by Richard Connell. Off there to the right somewhere is a large island, said Whitney. It's rather a mystery.
What island is it? Rainsford asked.
The old charts call it Ship Trap Island, Whitney replied. A suggestive name, isn't it? Sailors have a curious dread of the place, I don't know why. Some superstition. Can't see it, remarked Rainsford, trying to peer through the dank tropical night that was palpable as it pressed its thick black warmness in upon the yacht. You've good eyes, said Whitney, with a laugh, and I've seen you pick off a moose moving in the brown fall bush at 400 yards, but even you can't see 4 miles or so through a moonless Caribbean night.
Nor 4 yards, admitted Rainsford.
Ugh, it's like moist black velvet.
It will be light enough in Rio, promised Whitney. We should make it in a few days. I hope the Jaguar guns have come from Purdy's. We should have some good hunting up the Amazon.
Great sport, hunting.
The best sport in the world, agreed Rainsford.
For the hunter, amended Whitney, not for the Jaguar.
Don't talk rot, Whitney, said Rainsford. You're a big game hunter, not a philosopher. Who cares how a Jaguar feels?
Perhaps the Jaguar does, observed Whitney.
Bah, they've no understanding.
Even so, I rather think they understand one thing. Fear. The fear of pain. And the fear of death.
Ha! Nonsense, laughed Rainsford. This hot weather is making you soft, Whitney. Be a realist. The world is made up of two classes. The hunters and the huntees. Luckily, you and I are hunters. Do you think we've passed that island yet?
I can't tell in the dark. I hope so.
Why? Asked Rainsford.
The place has a reputation. A bad one.
Cannibals? Suggested Rainsford. Hardly. Even cannibals wouldn't live in such a godforsaken place.
But it's gotten into sailor lore somehow. Didn't you notice that the crew's nerves seemed a bit jumpy today?
They were a bit strange, now you mention it. Even Captain Nielsen.
Yes, even that tough-minded old Swede who'd go up to the devil himself and ask him for a light. Those fishy blue eyes held a look I never saw there before. All I could get out of him was, "This place has an evil name among seafaring men, sir." Then he said to me very gravely, "Don't you feel anything?" As if the air about was actually poisonous. Now, you mustn't laugh when I tell you this. I did feel something like a sudden chill. There was no breeze. The sea was as flat as a plate glass window. We were drawing near the island then. What I felt was a mental chill, a sort of sudden dread.
Pure imagination, said Rainsford. One superstitious sailor can taint the whole ship's company with his fear.
Maybe. But sometimes I think sailors have an extra sense that tells them when they are in danger. Sometimes I think evil is a tangible thing, with wavelengths, just as sound and light have. An evil place can, so to speak, broadcast vibrations of evil.
Anyhow, I'm glad we're getting out of this zone. Well, I think I'll turn in now, Rainsford.
I'm not sleepy, said Rainsford.
I'm going to smoke another pipe up on the after deck. Good night then, Rainsford. See you at breakfast. Right. Good night, Whitney. There was no sound in the dark as Rainsford sat there, but the muffled throb of the engine that drove the yacht swiftly through the darkness and the swish and ripple of the wash of the propeller. Rainsford, reclining in a steamer chair, indolently puffed on his favourite briar. The sensuous drowsiness of the night was upon him. It's so dark, he thought, that I could sleep without closing my eyes. The night would be my eyelids. An abrupt sound startled him. Off to the right he heard it, and his ears, expert in such matters, could not be mistaken. Again he heard the sound, and again, somewhere off in the blackness, someone had fired a gun 3 times. Rainsford sprang up and moved quickly to the rail, mystified. He strained his eyes in the direction from which the reports had come, but it was like trying to see through a blanket. He leaped upon the rail and balanced himself there to get greater elevation. His pipe, striking a rope, was knocked from his mouth. He lunged for it. A short, hoarse cry came from his lips as he realized he had reached too far and had lost his balance. The cry was pinched off short as the blood-warm waters of the Caribbean Sea dosed over his head. He struggled up to the surface and tried to cry out, but the wash from the speeding yacht slapped him in the face, and the salt water in his open mouth made him gag and strangle. Desperately, he struck out with strong strokes after the receding lights of the yacht, but he stopped before he had swum 50 feet. A certain cool-headedness had come to him. It was not the first time he had been in a tight place. There was a chance that his cries could be heard by someone aboard the yacht, but that chance was slender and grew more slender as the yacht raced on. He wrestled himself out of his clothes and shouted with all his power. The lights of the yacht became faint and ever-vanishing fireflies. Then they were blotted out entirely by the night. Rainsford remembered the shots. They had come from the right, and doggedly he swam in that direction, swimming with low, deliberate strokes, conserving his strength. For a seemingly endless time he fought the sea. He began to count his strokes. He could do possibly 100 more, and then Rainsford heard a sound. It came out of the darkness, a high screaming sound, the sound of an animal in an extremity of anguish and terror. He did not recognize the animal that made the sound. He did not try to. With fresh vitality, he swam toward the sound. He heard it again. Then it was cut short by another noise, crisp, staccato. "Pistol shot," muttered Rainsford, swimming on. 10 minutes of determined effort brought another sound to his ears, the most welcome he had ever heard, the muttering and growling of the sea breaking on a rocky shore. He was almost on the rocks before he saw them. On a night less calm, he would have been shattered against them. With his remaining strength, he dragged himself from the swirling waters. Jagged crags appeared to jut up into the opaqueness. He forced himself upward, hand over hand, gasping. His hands raw, he reached a flat place at the top. Dense jungle came down to the very edge of the cliffs. What perils that tangle of trees and underbrush might hold for him did not concern Rainsford just then. All he knew was that he was safe from his enemy, the sea, and that utter weariness was upon him. He flung himself down at the jungle edge and tumbled headlong into the deepest sleep of his life. When he opened his eyes, he knew from the position of the sun that it was late in the afternoon. Sleep had given him new vigour. A sharp hunger was picking at him. He looked about him almost cheerfully. Where there are pistol shots, there are men. Where there are men, there is food, he thought. But what kind of men, he wondered, in so forbidding a place? An unbroken front of snarled and ragged jungle fringed the shore. He saw no sign of a trail through the closely knit web of weeds and trees. It was easier to go along the shore, and Rainsford floundered along by the water. Not far from where he landed, he stopped. Some wounded thing, by the evidence, a large animal, had thrashed about in the underbrush. The jungle weeds were crushed down, and the moss was lacerated. One patch of weeds was stained crimson. A small glittering object not far away caught Rainsford's eye, and he picked it up. It was an empty cartridge. A 22, he remarked. That's odd. It must have been a fairly large animal, too. The hunter had his nerve with him to tackle it with a light gun. It's clear that the brute put up a fight. I suppose the first three shots I heard was when the hunter flushed his quarry and wounded it. The last shot was when he trailed it here and finished it. He examined along the ground closely and found what he had hoped to find, the print of hunting boots. They pointed along the cliff in the direction he had been going. Eagerly he hurried along, now slipping on a rotten log or loose stone, but making headway. Night was beginning to settle down on the island. Bleak darkness was blacking out the sea and jungle when Rainsford sighted the lights. He came upon them as he turned a crook in the coastline, and his first thought was that he had come upon a village, for there were many lights. But as he forged along, he saw to his great astonishment that all the lights were in one enormous building, a lofty structure with pointed towers plunging upward into the gloom. His eyes made out the shadowy outlines of a palatial chateau. It was set on a high bluff, and on three sides of it cliffs dived down to where the sea licked greedy lips in the shadows. Mirage, thought Rainsford. But it was no mirage, he found, when he opened the tall, spiked iron gate. The stone steps were real enough. The massive door with the leering gargoyle for a knocker was real enough. Yet above it all hung an air of unreality. He lifted the knocker and it creaked up stiffly as if it had never before been used. He let it fall and it startled him with its booming loudness. He thought he heard steps within. The door remained closed. Again Rainsford lifted the heavy knocker and let it fall. The door opened then, opened as suddenly as if it were on a spring, and Rainsford stood blinking in the river of glaring gold light that poured out. The first thing Rainsford's eyes discerned was the largest man Rainsford had ever seen, a gigantic creature, solidly made and black-bearded to the waist. In his hand the man held a long-barreled revolver, and he was pointing it straight at Rainsford's heart. Out of the snarl of beard, two small eyes regarded Rainsford. "Don't be alarmed," said Rainsford, with the smile which he hoped was disarming. "I'm no robber. I fell off a yacht. My name is Sanger Rainsford, of New York City." The menacing look in his eyes did not change. The revolver was pointing as rigidly as if the giant were a statue. He gave no sign that he understood Rainsford's words, or that he had even heard them. He was dressed in uniform, a black uniform trimmed with grey astrakhan. "I'm Sanger Rainsford of New York," Rainsford began again. "I fell off a yacht. I am hungry." The man's only answer was to raise with his thumb the hammer of his revolver. Then Rainsford saw the man's free hand go to his forehead in a military salute, and he saw him click his heels together and stand at attention. Another man was coming down the broad marble steps, an erect, slender man in evening clothes. He advanced to Rainsford and held out his hand. In a cultivated voice marked by a slight accent that gave it added precision and deliberateness, he said, "It is a very great pleasure and honour to welcome Mr. Sanger Rainsford, the celebrated hunter, to my home." Automatically, Rainsford shook the man's hand. "I've read your book about hunting snow leopards in Tibet, you see," explained the man. "I am General Zaroff." Rainsford's first impression was that the man was singularly handsome. His second was that there was an original, almost bizarre quality to the general's face. He was a tall man past middle age, for his hair was a vivid white, but his thick eyebrows and pointed military moustache were as black as the night from which Rainsford had come. His eyes, too, were black and very bright. He had high cheekbones, a sharp, cut nose, a spare, dark face, the face of a man used to giving orders, the face of an aristocrat. Turning to the giant in uniform, the general made a sign. The giant put away his pistol, saluted, withdrew. "Ivan is an incredibly strong fellow," remarked the general, "but he has the misfortune to be deaf and dumb. A simple fellow, but I'm afraid, like all his race, a bit of a savage."
"Is he Russian?"
"He is a Cossack," said the general, and his smile showed red lips and pointed teeth. "So am I." "Come," he said. "We shouldn't be chatting here. We can talk later. Now you want clothes, food, rest. You shall have them. This is a most restful spot." Ivan had reappeared, and the general spoke to him with lips that moved but gave forth no sound. "Follow Ivan, if you please, Mr. Rainsford," said the general. "I was about to have my dinner when you came. I'll wait for you. You'll find that my clothes will fit you, I think." It was to a huge beam-ceilinged bedroom with a canopied bed big enough for six men that Rainsford followed the silent giant. Ivan laid out an evening suit, and Rainsford, as he put it on, noticed that it came from a London tailor who ordinarily cut and sewed for none below the rank of duke. The dining room to which Ivan conducted him was in many ways remarkable. There was a medieval magnificence about it. It suggested a baronial hall of feudal times, with its oaken panels, its high ceiling, its vast refectory tables, where 20 men could sit down to eat. About the hall were mounted the heads of many animals: lions, tigers, elephants, moose, bears. Larger or more perfect specimens Rainsford had never seen. At the great table, the general was sitting, alone. "You'll have a cocktail, Mr. Rainsford," he suggested. The cocktail was surpassingly good, and Rainsford noted the table appointments were of the finest: the linen, the crystal, the silver, the china. They were eating borscht, the rich red soup with whipped cream so dear to Russian palates. Half apologetically, General Zaroff said, "We do our best to preserve the amenities of civilization here. Please forgive any lapses. We are well off the beaten track, you know. Do you think the champagne has suffered from its long ocean trip?" "Not in the least," declared Rainsford. He was finding the general a most thoughtful and affable host, a true cosmopolite. But there was one small trait of the general's that made Rainsford uncomfortable. Whenever he looked up from his plate, he found the general studying him, appraising him narrowly. "Perhaps," said General Zaroff, "you were surprised that I recognized your name. You see, I have read all books on hunting published in English, French, and Russian. I have but one passion in life, Mr. Rainsford, and it is the hunt." "You have some wonderful heads here," said Rainsford as he ate a particularly well-cooked filet mignon. "That Cape buffalo is the largest I ever saw." "Oh, that fellow. Yes, he was a monster."
"Did he charge you?"
"Hurled me against a tree," said the general. "Fractured my skull. But I got the brute."
"I've always thought," said Rainsford, "that the Cape buffalo is the most dangerous of all big game." For a moment the general did not reply. He was smiling his curious red-lipped smile. Then he said slowly,
No, you are wrong, sir. The Cape buffalo is not the most dangerous big game." He sipped his wine. "Here in my preserve on this island," he said in the same slow tone, "I hunt more dangerous game."
Rainsford expressed his surprise. "Is there big game on this island?"
The general nodded. "The biggest."
"Really?"
"Oh, it is naturally here, of course. I have to stock the island."
"What have you imported, General?" Rainsford asked. "Tigers?"
The general smiled. "No," he said. "Hunting tigers ceased to interest me some years ago. I exhausted their possibilities, you see. No thrill left in tigers. No real danger. I live for danger, Mr. Rainsford."
The general took from his pocket a gold cigarette case and offered his guest a long black cigarette with a silver tip. It was perfumed and gave off a smell like incense.
"We will have some capital hunting, you and I," said the general. "I shall be most glad to have your society."
"But what game?" began Rainsford.
"I'll tell you," the general said. "You will be amused, I know. I think I may say in all modesty that I have done a rare thing. I have invented a new sensation. May I pour you another glass of port?"
Thank you, General."
The general filled both glasses and said, "God makes some men poets. Some he makes kings, some beggars. Me, he made a hunter. My hand was made for the trigger, my father said. He was a very rich man with 250,000 acres in the Crimea.
and he was an ardent sportsman. When I was only 5 years old, he gave me a little gun, specially made in Moscow for me, to shoot sparrows with. When I shot some of his prized turkeys with it, he did not punish me. He complimented me on my marksmanship. I killed my first bear in the Caucasus when I was 10. My whole life has been one prolonged hunt. I went into the army, it was expected of noblemen's sons, and for a time commanded a division of Cossack cavalry. But my real interest was always the hunt. I have hunted every kind of game in every land. It would be impossible for me to tell you how many animals I've killed. The general puffed at his cigarette. After the debacle in Russia, I left the country, for it was imprudent for an officer of the Tsar to stay there. Many noble Russians lost everything. I, luckily, had invested heavily in American securities, so I shall never have to open a tea room in Monte Carlo or drive a taxi in Paris. Naturally, I continued to hunt. Grizzlies in your Rockies, crocodiles up in the Ganges, rhinoceroses in East Africa. It was in Africa that the Cape buffalo hit me and laid me up for 6 months. As soon as I recovered, I started for the Amazon to hunt jaguars, for I'd heard they were unusually cunning. They weren't. The Cossack sighed. They were no match at all for a hunter with his wits about him and a high-powered rifle. I was bitterly disappointed. I was lying in my tent with a splitting headache one night when a terrible thought pushed its way into my mind. Hunting was beginning to bore me. And hunting, remember, had been my life. I have heard that in America, businessmen often go to pieces when they give up the business that has been their life. Yes, that's so, said Rainsford. The general smiled. I had no wish to go to pieces, he said. I must do something. Now, mine is an analytical mind, Mr. Rainsford. Doubtless that is why I enjoy the problems of the chase. No doubt, General Zaroff. So, continued the general, I asked myself why the hunt no longer fascinated me. You are a much younger man than I am, Mr. Rainsford, and have not hunted as much, but perhaps you can guess the answer? What was it? Simply this. Hunting had ceased to be what you call a sporting proposition. It had become too easy. I always got my quarry. Always. There is no greater bore than perfection. The general lit a fresh cigarette. No animal had a chance with me anymore. That is no boast, it is a mathematical certainty. The animal had nothing but his legs and his instinct. Instinct is no match for reason. When I thought of this, it was a tragic moment for me, I can tell you. Rainsford leaned across the table, absorbed in what his host was saying. It came to me as an inspiration what I must do, the general went on. And that was? The general smiled, the quiet smile of one who has faced an obstacle and surmounted it with success. I had to invent a new animal to hunt, he said. A new animal? You're joking. Not at all, said the general. I never joke about hunting. I needed a new animal. I found one. So I bought this island, built this house, and here I do my hunting. The island is perfect for my purposes. There are jungles with a maze of trails in them, hills, swamps. But the animal, General Zaroff. Oh, said the general. It supplies me with the most exciting hunting in the world. No other hunting compares with it for an instant. Every day I hunt and I never grow bored now, for I have a quarry with which I can match my wits. Rainsford's bewilderment showed in his face. I wanted the ideal animal to hunt, explained the general. So I said, what are the attributes of an ideal quarry? The answer was, of course, it must have courage, cunning, and above all, it must be able to reason. But no animal can reason, objected Rainsford. My dear fellow, said the general, there is one that can. But you can't mean, gasped Rainsford. And why not? I can't believe you are serious, General Zaroff. This is a grisly joke. Why should I not be serious? I am speaking of hunting. Hunting? Great guns, General Zaroff. What you speak of is murder.
The general laughed with entire good nature. He regarded Rainsford quizzically.
I refuse to believe that so modern and civilized a young man as you seem to be harbors romantic ideas about the value of human life. Surely your experiences in the war did not make me condone cold-blooded murder, finished Rainsford stiffly.
Laughter shook the general.
How extraordinarily droll you are, he said. One does not expect nowadays to find a young man of the educated class, even in America, with such a naive and, if I may say so, mid-Victorian point of view. It's like finding a snuffbox in a limousine.
Oh well, doubtless you had Puritan ancestors. So many Americans appear to have had.
I'll wager you'll forget your notions when you go hunting with me.
You've a genuine new thrill in store for you, Mr. Rainsford.
Thank you. I am a hunter, not a murderer.
Dear me, said the general, quite unruffled.
Again, that unpleasant word.
But I think I can show you that your scruples are quite ill-founded.
Yes?
Life is for the strong, to be lived by the strong, and if needs be, taken by the strong. The weak of the world were put here to give the strong pleasure. I am strong. Why should I not use my gift? If I wish to hunt, why should I not? I hunt the scum of the earth. Sailors from tramp ships, lassers, blacks, Chinese, whites, mongrels. A thoroughbred horse or hound is worth more than a score of them.
But they are men, said Rainsford hotly.
Precisely, said the general. That is why I use them. It gives me pleasure. They can reason, after a fashion. So they are dangerous.
But where do you get them?
The general's left eyelid fluttered down in a wink.
This island is called Ship Trap, he answered.
Sometimes an angry god of the high seas sends them to me. Sometimes, when Providence is not so kind, I help Providence a bit. Come to the window with me.
Rainsford went to the window and looked out toward the sea.
Watch, out there, exclaimed the general, pointing into the night. Rainsford's eyes saw only blackness, and then, as the general pressed a button far out to sea, Rainsford saw the flash of lights. The general chuckled.
They indicate a channel, he said. Where there's none, giant rocks with razor edges crouch like a sea monster with wide-open jaws. They can crush a ship as easily as I can crush this nut.
He dropped a walnut on the hardwood floor and brought his heel grinding down on it.
Oh, yes, he said,
casually, as if in answer to a question. I have electricity. We try to be civilized here.
Civilized? And you shoot down men?
A trace of anger was in the general's black eyes. But it was there for but a second, and he said in his most pleasant manner,
Dear me, what a righteous young man you are.
I assure you I do not do the thing you suggest. That would be barbarous.
I treat these visitors with every consideration. They get plenty of good food and exercise. They get into splendid physical condition. You shall see for yourself tomorrow.
What do you mean?
We'll visit my training school, smiled the general. It's in the cellar. I have about a dozen pupils down there now. They're from the Spanish bark San Lucar, that had the bad luck to go on the rocks out there. A very inferior lot, I regret to say. Poor specimens and more accustomed to the deck than to the jungle. He raised his hand and Ivan, who served as a waiter, brought thick Turkish coffee.
Rainsford, with an effort, held his tongue in cheek.
It's a game, you see, pursued the general blandly. I suggest to one of them that we go hunting. I give him a supply of food and an excellent hunting knife. I give him 3 hours' start. I am to follow, armed with only a pistol of the smallest caliber and range. If my quarry eludes me for 3 whole days, he wins the game. If I find him, the general smiled, he loses.
Suppose he refuses to be hunted.
Oh, said the general, I give him his option, of course. He need not play that game if he does not wish to. If he does not wish to hunt, I turn him over to Ivan. Ivan once had the honour of serving as official knouter to the great White Tsar, and he has his own ideas of sport. Invariably, Mr. Rainsford, invariably they choose the hunt. And if they win? The smile on the general's face widened. To date I have not lost, he said. Then he added hastily, I don't wish you to think me a braggart, Mr. Rainsford. Many of them afford only the most elementary sort of problem. Occasionally I strike a Tartar. One almost did win. I eventually had to use the dogs.
The dogs?
This way, please. I'll show you. The general steered Rainsford to a window. The lights from the windows sent a flickering illumination that made grotesque patterns on the courtyard below, and Rainsford could see moving about there a dozen or so huge black shapes. As they turned toward him, their eyes glittered greenly.
A rather good lot, I think, observed the general. They are let out at 7 every night. If anyone should try to get into my house or out of it, something extremely regrettable would occur to him. He hummed a snatch of song from the Folies Bergère.
And now, said the general, I want to show you my new collection of heads. Will you come with me to the library?
I hope, said Rainsford, that you will excuse me tonight, General Zaroff. I'm really not feeling well.
Ah, indeed, the general inquired solicitously. Well, I suppose that's only natural after your long swim. You need a good, restful night's sleep. Tomorrow you'll feel like a new man, I'll wager. Then we'll hunt, eh? I've one rather promising prospect.
Rainsford was hurrying from the room.
Sorry you can't go with me tonight, called the general. I expect rather fair sport. A big, strong black man. He looks resourceful.
Well, good night, Mr. Rainsford. I hope you have a good night's rest.
The bed was good and the pajamas of the softest silk, and he was tired in every fibre of his being, but nevertheless Rainsford could not quiet his brain with the opiate of sleep. He lay, eyes wide open. Once he thought he heard stealthy steps in the corridor outside his room. He sought to throw open the door. It would not open. He went to the window and looked out. His room was high up in one of the towers. The lights of the chateau were out now, and it was dark and silent, but there was a fragment of sallow moon, and by its wan light he could see dimly the courtyard. There, weaving in and out in the pattern of shadow, were black, noiseless forms. The hounds heard him at the window and looked up expectantly with their green eyes. Rainsford went back to the bed and lay down. By many methods, he tried to put himself to sleep. He had achieved a doze when, just as morning began to come, he heard far off in the jungle the faint report of a pistol. General Zaroff did not appear until luncheon. He was dressed faultlessly in the tweeds of a country squire. He was solicitous about the state of Rainsford's health.
As for me, sighed the general, I do not feel so well. I am worried, Mr. Rainsford. Last night I detected traces of my old complaint.
To Rainsford's questioning glance, the general said,
ennui,
boredom. Then, taking a second helping of crepe Suzette, the general explained,
the hunting was not good last night. The fellow lost his head. He made a straight trail that offered no problems at all. That's the trouble with these sailors. They have dull brains to begin with, and they do not know how to get about in the woods. They do excessively stupid and obvious things. It's most annoying. Will you have another glass of Chablis, Mr. Rainsford?
General, said Rainsford firmly, I wish to leave this island at once. The general raised his thickets of eyebrows. He seemed hurt.
But my dear fellow, the general protested, you've only just come. You've had no hunting.
I wish to go today, said Rainsford. He saw the dead black eyes of the general on him, studying him. General Zaroff's face suddenly brightened. He filled Rainsford's glass with the venerable Chablis from a dusty bottle.
Tonight, said the general, we will hunt, you and I.
Rainsford shook his head. No, general, he said. I will not hunt.
The general shrugged his shoulders and delicately ate a hothouse grape. "As you wish, my friend," he said. "The choice rests entirely with you, but may I not venture to suggest that you will find my idea of sport more diverting than Ivan's?" He nodded toward the corner where the giant stood, scowling, his thick arms crossed on his hog's head of a chest.
"You don't mean," cried Rainsford.
"My dear fellow," said the general, "have I not told you I always mean what I say about hunting? This is really an inspiration. I drink to a foeman worthy of my steel, at last." The general raised his glass, but Rainsford sat staring at him. "You'll find this game worth playing," the general said enthusiastically. "Your brain against mine, your woodcraft against mine, your strength and stamina against mine. Outdoor chess, and the stake is not without value, eh?"
"And if I win," began Rainsford huskily,
"I'll cheerfully acknowledge myself defeat if I do not find you by the midnight of the third day," said General Zaroff. "My sloop will place you on the mainland near a town."
The general read what Rainsford was thinking.
Oh, you can trust me," said the Cossack. "I will give you my word as a gentleman and a sportsman. Of course, you, in turn, must agree to say nothing of your visit here."
"I'll agree to nothing of the kind," said Rainsford.
"Oh," said the general.
"In that case,
but why discuss that now? 3 days hence we can discuss it over a bottle of Veuve Clicquot, unless..." The general sipped his wine. Then a businesslike air animated him.
"Ivan," he said to Rainsford, "will supply you with hunting clothes, food, a knife.
I suggest you wear moccasins, they leave a poorer trail. I suggest too that you avoid the big swamp in the southeast corner of the island. We call it Death Swamp. There's quicksand there. One foolish fellow tried it. The deplorable part of it was that Lazarus followed him. You can imagine my feelings, Mr. Rainsford. I loved Lazarus. He was the finest hound in my pack. Well, I must beg you to excuse me now. I always take a siesta after lunch. You'll hardly have time for a nap, I fear. You'll want to start, no doubt. I shall not follow till dusk. Hunting at night is so much more exciting than by day, don't you think? Au revoir, Mr. Rainsford. Au revoir." General Zaroff, with a deep, courtly bow, strolled from the room. From another door came Ivan. Under one arm he carried khaki hunting clothes, a haversack of food, a leather sheath containing a long-bladed hunting knife. His right hand rested on a cocked revolver thrust in the crimson sash about his waist. Rainsford had fought his way through the bush for 2 hours. "I must keep my nerve. I must keep my nerve," he said through tight teeth. He had not been entirely clear-headed when the shadow gate snapped shut behind him. His whole idea at first was to put distance between himself and General Zaroff. And to this end, he had plunged along, spurred on by the sharp roars of something very like panic. Now he had got a grip on himself, had stopped, and was taking stock of himself and the situation. He saw that straight flight was futile. Inevitably, it would bring him face to face with the sea. He was in a picture with a frame of water, and his operations clearly must take place within that frame. "I'll give him a trail to follow," muttered Rainsford, and he struck off from the rude path he had been following into the trackless wilderness. He executed a series of intricate loops. He doubled on his trail again and again, recalling all the lore of the fox hunt and all the dodges of the fox. Night found him leg-weary, with hands and face lashed by the branches on a thickly wooded ridge. He knew it would be insane to blunder on through the dark, even if he had the strength. His need for rest was imperative, and he thought, "I have played the fox. Now I must play the cat of the fable." A big tree with a thick trunk and outspread branches was nearby, and taking care not to leave the slightest mark, he climbed up into the crotch and, stretching out on one of the broad limbs after a fashion, rested. Rest brought him new confidence and almost a feeling of security. Even so zealous a hunter as General Zaroff could not trace him there, he told himself. Only the devil himself could follow that complicated trail through the jungle after dark. But perhaps the general was a devil. An apprehensive night crawled slowly by like a wounded snake, and sleep did not visit Rainsford, although the silence of a dead world was on the jungle. Toward morning, when a dingy grey was varnishing the sky, the cry of some startled bird focused Rainsford's attention in that direction. Something was coming through the bush, coming slowly, carefully, coming by the same winding way Rainsford had come. He flattened himself down on the limb, and through a screen of leaves almost as thick as tapestry he watched. That which was approaching was a man. It was General Zaroff. He made his way along with his eyes fixed in utmost concentration on the ground before him. He paused almost beneath the tree, dropped to his knees and studied the ground. Rainsford's impulse was to hurl himself down like a panther, but he saw that the general's right hand held something metallic, a small automatic pistol. The hunter shook his head several times, as if he were puzzled. Then he straightened up and took from his case one of his black cigarettes. Its pungent incense-like smoke floated up to Rainsford's nostrils. Rainsford held his breath. The general's eyes had left the ground and were travelling inch by inch up the tree. Rainsford froze there, every muscle tensed for a spring, but the sharp eyes of the hunter stopped before they reached the limb where Rainsford lay. A smile spread over his brown face. Very deliberately, he blew a smoke ring into the air. Then he turned his back on the tree and walked carelessly away, back along the trail he had come. The swish of the underbrush against his hunting boots grew fainter and fainter. The pent-up air burst hotly from Rainsford's lungs. His first thought made him feel sick and numb. The general could follow a trail through the woods at night. He could follow an extremely difficult trail. He must have uncanny powers. Only by the merest chance had the Cossack failed to see his quarry. Rainsford's second thought was even more terrible. It sent a shudder of cold horror through his whole being. Why had the general smiled? Why had he turned back? Rainsford did not want to believe what his reason told him was true, but the truth was as evident as the sun that had by now pushed through the morning mists. The general was playing with him. The general was saving him for another day's sport. The Cossack was the cat. He was the mouse. Then it was that Rainsford knew the full meaning of terror. "I will not lose my nerve. I will not." He slid down from the tree and struck off again into the woods. His face was set and he forced the machinery of his mind to function. 300 yards from his hiding place he stopped, where a huge dead tree leaned precariously on a smaller living one. Throwing off his sack of food, Rainsford took his knife from its sheath and began to work with all his energy. The job was finished at last, and he threw himself down behind a fallen log 100 feet away. He did not have to wait long. The cat was coming to play with the mouse. Following the trail with the sureness of a bloodhound came General Zaroff. Nothing escaped those searching black eyes. No crushed blade of grass, no bent twig, no mark, no matter how faint, in the moss. So intent was the Cossack on his stalking that he was upon the thing Rainsford had made before he saw it. His foot touched the protruding bough that was the trigger. Even as he touched it, the general sensed his danger and leaped back with the agility of an ape. But he was not quite quick enough. The dead tree, delicately adjusted to rest on the cut living one, crashed down and struck the general a glancing blow on the shoulder as it fell. But for his alertness, he must have been smashed beneath it. He staggered, but he did not fall, nor did he drop his revolver. He stood there rubbing his injured shoulder, and Rainsford, with fear again gripping his heart, heard the general's mocking laugh ring through the jungle. "Rainsford," called the general, "if you are within sound of my voice, as I suppose you are, let me congratulate you. Not many men know how to make a Malay man-catcher. Luckily for me, I too have hunted in Malacca. You are proving interesting, Mr. Rainsford. I'm going now to have my wound dressed. It's only a slight one. But I shall be back. I shall be back." When the general, nursing his bruised shoulder, had gone,
Rainsford took up his flight again. It was flight now, a desperate, hopeless flight that carried him on for some hours. Dusk came, then darkness, and still he pressed on. The ground grew softer under his moccasins, the vegetation grew ranker, denser. Insects bit him savagely. Then, as he stepped forward, his foot sank into the ooze. He tried to wrench it back, but the muck sucked viciously at his foot, as if it were a giant leech. With a violent effort, he tore his feet loose. He knew where he was now. Death Swamp, and its quicksand. His hands were tight closed, as if his nerve were something tangible that someone in the darkness was trying to tear from his grip. The softness of the earth had given him an idea. He stepped back from the quicksand, a dozen feet or so, and like some huge prehistoric beaver, he began to dig. Rainsford had dug himself in France when a second's delay meant death. That had been a placid pastime compared to his digging now. The pit grew deeper. When it was above his shoulders, he climbed out, and from some hard saplings he cut stakes and sharpened them to a fine point. These stakes he planted in the bottom of the pit, with the points sticking up. With flying fingers he wove a rough carpet of weeds and branches, and with it he covered the mouth of the pit. Then, wet with sweat and aching with tiredness, he crouched behind the stump of a lightning-charred tree. He knew his pursuer was coming. He heard the padding sound of feet on the soft earth, and the night breeze brought him the perfume of the general's cigarette. It seemed to Rainsford that the general was coming with unusual swiftness. He was not feeling his way along, foot by foot. Rainsford, crouching there, could not see the general, nor could he see the pit. He lived a year and a minute. Then he felt an impulse to cry aloud with joy, for he heard the sharp crackle of the breaking branches. As the cover of the pit gave way, he heard the sharp scream of pain as the pointed stakes found their mark. He leaped up from his place of concealment, then he cowered back. 3 feet from the pit, a man was standing, with an electric torch in his hand. "You've done well, Rainsford," the voice of the general called. "Your Burmese tiger pit has claimed one of my best dogs. Again, you score. I think, Mr. Rainsford, I'll see what you can do against my whole pack. I'm going home for a rest now. Thank you for a most amusing evening." At daybreak, Rainsford, lying near the swamp, was awakened by the sound that made him know he had new things to learn about fear. It was a distant sound, faint and wavering, but he knew it. It was the baying of a pack of hounds. Rainsford knew he could do one of two things. He could stay where he was and wait. That was suicide. He could flee. That was postponing the inevitable. For a moment he stood there, thinking. An idea that held a wild chance came to him. And, tightening his belt, he headed away from the swamp. The baying of the hounds drew nearer. Then, still nearer, nearer, ever nearer. On a ridge, Rainsford climbed a tree. Down a watercourse not a quarter of a mile away, he could see the bush moving. Straining his eyes, he saw the lean figure of General Zaroff. Just ahead of him, Rainsford made out another figure whose wide shoulders surged through the tall jungle weeds. It was the giant Ivan, and he seemed pulled forward by some unseen force. Rainsford knew that Ivan must be holding the pack in leash. They would be on him any minute now. His mind worked frantically. He thought of a native trick he had learned in Uganda. He slid down the tree. He caught hold of a springy young sapling, and to it he fastened his hunting knife, with the blade pointing down the trail. With a bit of wild grapevine, he tied back the sapling. Then he ran for his life. The hounds raised their voices as they hit the fresh scent. Rainsford knew now how an animal at bay feels. He had to stop to get his breath. The baying of the hounds stopped abruptly, and Rainsford's heart stopped too. They must have reached the knife. He shinned excitedly up a tree and looked back. His pursuers had stopped, but the hope that was in Rainsford's brain when he climbed died, for he saw in the shallow valley that General Zaroff was still on his feet.
but Ivan was not. The knife, driven by the recoil of the springing tree, had not wholly failed. Rainsford had hardly tumbled to the ground when the pack took up the cry again. "Nerve, nerve, nerve," he panted as he dashed along. A blue gap showed between the trees dead ahead. Even nearer drew the hounds. Rainsford forced himself on toward that gap. He reached it. It was the shore of the sea. Across a cove he could see the gloomy grey stone of the chateau. 20 feet below him, the sea rumbled and hissed. Rainsford hesitated. He heard the hounds. Then he leaped far out into the sea. When the general and his pack reached the place by the sea, the Cossacks stopped. For some minutes he stood regarding the blue-green expanse of water. He shrugged his shoulders. Then he sat down, took a drink of brandy from a silver flask, lit a cigarette, and hummed a bit from Madame Butterfly. General Zaroff had an exceedingly good dinner in his great paneled dining hall that evening. With it, he had a bottle of Paul Roger and half a bottle of Chambertin. Two slight annoyances kept him from perfect enjoyment. One was the thought that it would be difficult to replace Ivan. The other was that his quarry had escaped him. Of course, the American hadn't played the game. So thought the general as he tasted his after-dinner liqueur. In his library he read, to soothe himself, from the works of Marcus Aurelius. At 10 he went up to his bedroom. He was deliciously tired, he said to himself, as he locked himself in. There was a little moonlight, so before turning on the light he went to the window and looked down at the courtyard. He could see the great hounds, and he called, "Better look another time," to them. Then he switched on the light. A man who had been hiding in the curtains of the bed was standing there. "Rainsford," screamed the general. "How in God's name did you get here?" "Swam," said Rainsford. "I found it quicker than walking through the jungle." The general sucked in his breath and smiled. "I congratulate you," he said. "You have won the game." Rainsford did not smile. "I am still a beast at bay," he said in a low, hoarse voice. "Get ready, General Zaroff." The general made one of his deepest bows. "I see," he said. "Splendid. One of us is to furnish a repast for the hounds. The other will sleep in this very excellent bed." "On guard, Rainsford." He had never slept in a better bed, Rainsford decided.
And that was The Most Dangerous Game, also published as The Hounds of Zaroff, a short story by Richard Connell from 1924, first published actually in Collier's in the January 19th edition of that magazine. The reason I chose this story is because I knew I was going to be flying solo on this episode, and I just wanted a ripping good yarn, one that didn't require a huge amount of explanation, one that you could listen to and enjoy in that old-fashioned way of just being told a tale that you can fully comprehend as you go without there necessarily being any great levels of depth or nuance. Now, that said, this is a really interesting little story for other reasons apart altogether from the plot and the main maintenance of that tension throughout, and the drawing of those very interesting characters of Rainsford and Zaroff and Whitney. And of course, Ivan. Let's not forget Ivan. But as I've been doing of late, even on solo shows, I just wanted to take a second to have a look at some of the bigger ideas that were probably jumping around in your head as you were listening to it. Of the biggest themes, and I really like the idea of instinct versus reason. By putting Zaroff against Rainsford, in that sort of hunt dynamic, Connell can blur the lines between who we perceive as hunter and who we perceive as prey. Connell takes great pains in the build-up part of the story, where Zaroff is first getting to know Rainsford and vice versa, to sort of show us the difference between animal and man. And actually that has been prefigured in the conversation between Whitney and Rainsford
in the early going as well, where Rainsford sneers at Whitney for suggesting that the animals could have feelings and feel fear and anxiety. And Rainsford is very much of the great white hunter type that we've come to maybe not necessarily love, but certainly know. He is very much, we are the masters of the universe. Why should we not therefore use that strength? Now, it's very, very interesting because later on, that is exactly the type of line that Zaroff uses to justify his hunting of humans to Rainsford. Now, I would argue that instinct and reason are not necessarily just as mutually exclusive as is often put before us. I think we really misunderstand an awful lot of human nature and an awful lot of what it is that makes us tick, as it were. And although fiction has traditionally placed human intellect and our ability to work things out and reason well above, you know, the sort of primitive, bestial, instinctual reactions of animals who basically act on those impulses. They have no moral compulsion. They have no use of reason, simply that instinct that drives them to survive, that instinct to survive that drives them. Now, we've gone on to see by tipping around the edges that there are animals who have impulses other than instinct, who crave pleasure, who crave fun. This is to be found in nature. But similarly, you know, we have to admit that there are certain humans who are more bestial than others. Reason is what's supposed to allow us to work together, cooperate, to overcome those deeper instinctual reactions and operate as a society, operate with morals, operate with laws and rules. And the dichotomy between reason and instinct is really blurred by Connell when, as I said in that conversation with Whitney and Rainsford, it is Whitney who basically tells us that animals do instinctively feel fear. And he says, actually, when he talks about Ship Trap Island, that's really interesting, and how Captain Nielsen has sort of given him the fear by the way that he describes Ship Trap Island. Whitney admits to an instinctual reaction, a reaction that has nothing to do with reason and logic. It's pure emotion. It's chills. He admits that when he thinks about the island, it sparks kind of a sense of dread in him. A deep instinctual reaction, one that trumps everything else. I've always thought there's a very, very interesting conversation to be had around our instincts and why it is that they're there. Oftentimes, I worry about materialist scientists and how they break it down to these biological robot in a meaningless universe type explanations. It bugs me. It allows for nothing by way of a wider sense of consciousness, a kind of spirituality that has nothing to do with religion, but just an understanding of the world and perhaps a previous oneness with that world. One of the things that we know for sure is wired into our humanity as an instinct, just to compare and contrast the two things, is the reaction to the color red. And red is one of the motifs that runs, the idea of redness is one of the motifs that runs through this story in the early part particularly. And it's very skillfully done by Connell. He weaves that color red and obviously the immediate association with blood, which is where I'm getting to in a long-winded way, because that blood color, that redness that permeates the early part of the story kind of prefigures blood and violence and death, which are all to come when Rainsford ends up on Ship Trap Island. I think we first see it when Rainsford falls off the yacht and he's sort of immersed in the blood warm waters of the sea. This obviously kind of means, you know, in and of itself, this beautiful metaphor for his future submersion in violence and chaos and potential death. Then when Rainsford finds the island, finds himself washed up on the island and starts to get his bearings, he's having a look around, he can see, well, there has been an animal here, it's been crashing around, you can see the undergrowth is crushed down, and then all of a sudden he sees that patch of weeds that have been stained crimson, and again, that very visceral, literal, in that literal way, that visceral sign of something to fear. And this is where I was going with it. This, I think this is where we're hardwired as humans to react to the redness of the blood. It's an age-old signifier when we see it. You know, not necessarily you run around with your hair on fire, but you spring to action. You know, you react in that instinctive way to protect, to defend, to heal in whatever way you can short term. It's a very literally visceral signifier. And I think our man Connell leans heavily into that. And then later on, as the hunt is going on, and he moves further and further into the sort of innards of the island, the color red is sort of more related to Zaroff. Zaroff and his buddy Ivan. Ivan wears a crimson sash. Later, at least two times during the story, Zaroff's lips are referred to. He's a red-lipped smile. The fact that it's repeated, I think, is interesting, especially then when you compare and contrast the one of the references to his red lips. They also talk about his, pointed teeth, which again would suggest that Zaroff is like this apex predator. The blood red of his lips and the pointed teeth. He is, you know, this, like I say, figure to fear. One that our instinct should warn us against. Another idea that I loved was the effect that war and the military had on the two men. And the way that that's examined in the story. Rainsford and Zaroff have both had that military background. They are both wealthy, well-to-do men of the world, hunters, the 1% of the 1% you would hear of in today's society. They, however, have very, very different ways of looking at their wartime experiences or their military experiences. For example, when Zaroff speaks about his days in the Russian army, it was something that was expected of him and of the sons of nobility like he was. He has a brief time, but of course it's in command of a Cossack cavalry division. And the only things he really tells us about it is that it basically took him away from his true love, which was hunting. But Zaroff will not relinquish the title of general, which you will notice, because that adds to his sense of himself as being, like I said before, an apex predator, the pinnacle of society. He has, let's think about this for a second, bought his own island, turned it into this entirely dystopian universe in which he rules with an iron fist and which his whimsies and desires are fulfilled to his every level of satisfaction. He has the finest of champagnes and wines. He has the best of table dressings and clothing. He's living the life of the ultimate pampered Western gentleman. Like I said, the 1% of the 1% in a hellhole of his own creation in which he gets to play his own version of God. That's very, very interesting. So his idea of the military and of war was that idea of having power over and maintaining power and retaining stature and retaining status. And probably also very much enabled him to think of his fellow man as less than worthy of existence at times and as absolutely valid when it comes to the idea of man as prey. Again, you could see how that might feed, a time like that might feed a fellow who was inclined towards that level of psychopathy to maybe lean into it a little bit. And maybe, who knows how he indulged whatever sadistic side he has to him, whatever thrills he got while forced to slum it in the army, and who it was that suffered as a result. And in fact, when Rainsford points out that what Zaroff is doing is disgusting, that it's murder, he laughs at him. He tells him he's naive. He tells him that he's very self-righteous. He tells him that he's a prim Victorian. He refers to the fact that Rainsford, like most Americans, probably had puritanical parents with a capital P. But Rainsford's memory of war is different. Rainsford is reminded of his war days, of the harrowing brutality of war, of the fear, just the raw fear of war as a participant in war, when he is forced to dig his trench and to build that pit. But it reminds him of his time digging in against onrushing artillery coming in from the sky in World War One, and the, like I say, sense of absolute desperation and dread and powerlessness that was associated with that. So our great white hunter becomes the hunted, and he feels the feelings of desperation, of anxiety, of fear that the prey has felt in all the times that he has been hunting it and denying the fact that those feelings were real. And when you think that in the end, it is Rainsford who emerges as the actual apex predator, you wonder, because we're left to believe that he takes Zaroff's life. And then he sleeps quite contentedly in that bed. Zaroff himself has said that he'll probably be a meal for the hounds. What has Rainsford emerged like? Who has emerged from the jungle? What has Rainsford become? Has it absolutely underlined his feelings of decency and an affection for his common man and the idea that what Zaroff was doing was absolutely outrageous? Or has in fact it underlined his idea of himself as the apex predator, as the entitled great white hunter, as the man who takes what he wants by force? It's an interesting little query that we're left with at the end, and I can't tell you for sure what it would be that the answer to that question would be. This one, I've enjoyed very much talking to you about this one briefly. I hope soon that we'll be back to a two-man show with Neil in tow. But until then, I won't be letting up. There will be a minimum of one a month. All the extra stuff will be going up on the executive producer and producer section of the website, greatstoriespod.com. If you're listening to this and you haven't checked out that website, please do go to greatstoriespod.com and consider becoming a sustaining patron of this show, someone who helps me to ultimately make this a show that happens once a week instead of once a month, a show that can have all sorts of offshoots on it, where we do novels, we do non-fiction, and we do all sorts of other wonderful things under the Great Stories umbrella. I have so many plans and hopes and dreams for this, folks. They can only come true if I get a little bit of support. And I massively appreciate those of you who are doing it. You're absolute legends of humans. Thank you so much to the ongoing subscribers. Thank you so much to the one-off donors. I'm hoping that with a surge of new material now, that people will feel it, if not incumbent on them, then a sort of an inclination to donate or to contribute in some way. Of course, from a free contribution point of view, please tell people about the show. I love word of mouth. I think it's old-fashioned but very effective. I also love when people use their socials to push the show. Reviews, I know you hear it on every podcast you listen to, but if you take the time to go to Apple Podcasts and do that review, it will get me further eyeballs and ear holes on the show, and that's literally all I'm about at the moment, is trying to grow this. So anything you can do at all to help us progress and to develop would be massively appreciated, whether it's a financial contribution or otherwise. As ever, thanks so much for listening. I'll have another one for you within a fortnight. That's a promise. I have at least two recorded, so it's just a matter of processing them. I was hoping for a different turn of events in terms of the makeup of the personnel on the show, but things are a little bit tricky at the moment, so I'll keep going with these solo ones. And I've had a couple of very nice responses to these solo shows, so thank you so much for that, and hopefully they're not too much of a grind for those of you who prefer the other format. That's enough for me. We'll speak to you soon, and thanks for listening.